Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half here on Premier Christian Radio and online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And what a special show we have in store for you today. I'm joined here on the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking by William Lane Craig, one of the foremost Christian defenders in the world. That is, of course, because in 5 weeks' time, his UK tour kicks off. Premier Christian Radio is a big part of that, along with the organisations UCCF and Damaris. And we're going to be seeing Bill Craig over here for the first time since 2007, defending the Christian faith in a number of lectures and debates around the country, and an Apologetics Day conference in London. So there's some fabulous events, some fabulous dates going on. I'll be telling you more about them in the course of today's programme. But it all kicks off on Monday, the 17th of October. That's just over 5 weeks' time. And it's with a debate between Bill and Stephen Law. At the time I recorded the programme you're about to hear with Bill, we had not established whether Stephen Law would be available to debate Bill. And that was because, as you'll hear in the course of today's programme, at the time there had just recently been the withdrawal of Polly Toynbee as his atheist opponent. That put us in a spot of difficulty, but Stephen Law has since agreed to step in for Polly Toynbee, who is the head of the British Humanist Association. But Stephen Law is an atheist philosopher, editor of the Royal Institute of Philosophy's magazine Think, and that should be a fantastic debate on Does God Exist at Westminster Central Hall, starting off the tour in London on Monday the 17th of October, 7:30 p.m. Do get along. I'll be hosting that event. It'll be great to see you there. It's all available to be booked at premier.org.uk/Craig. premier.org.uk/Craig is to go the place to go to for the tickets. You can also find a Facebook page that we've created for the tour where you can get updates and information, and you can also sign up to the Facebook events there as well. That's facebook.com/reasonablefaithtour. You can of course find the links for all of this from the Unbelievable webpage, premier.org.uk/Unbelievable. Right now, let's get into today's very exciting programme. You're unbelievable. Well, welcome along to the programme, and what a treat we have for you in store today. As I say, William Lane Craig, my guest on today's programme, for a special preview of the forthcoming tour in October here in the UK. I'm privileged to be part of the organising committee for that. William Lane Craig joins us today to take your questions. You've been emailing me, you've been also sending them in on Facebook, on Twitter, on the Unbelievable page of the Premier community. Your questions to one of the premier Christian philosophers in the world, William Lane Craig, who joins us for our programme today. We'll be looking at things like the Kalam cosmological argument, the moral argument, the fine-tuning of the universe, the resurrection, and other areas that you've got questions for Bill. Stay tuned to the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable. Well, first of all, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to the programme today, Bill. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure, Justin.
It's great to have you back again. We last had you in conversation back at the beginning of the year, reviewing your panel discussion with Richard Dawkins in Mexico of last year. And then more recently, we were privileged to be able to play out the debate you had with A.C. Grayling from 2005 on the problem of evil, which went down really well. A great number of downloads of that, which was a good thing to do. But we've got you on today, of course, because of the forthcoming tour. Very excited. A lot of excitement building about the lectures and the debates that you'll be taking part in over the course of the week and a half that you're with us here in the UK. Starts, of course, in London on Monday, the 17th of October, and that'll be at Westminster Central Hall, one of the prime venues in London for this kind of an event. You'll be debating the existence of God. And before we go into some of the elements surrounding that, let's also introduce my other guest in the studio today, Peter May. Peter, thank you for joining me today.
Not at all. Good to be here.
Not the first time on the programme, though. It was a few years ago that you joined me for a discussion with John Loftus,
That's right.
It was, on his particular views. But great to have you back again today. Peter, you recently retired as the chairman of UCCF.
That's right.
And that's the University and Colleges Christian Fellowship. You're involved in the tour, so we'll get some of the detail from you as we go on in the programme today. But Bill, returning to you, we're so looking forward to having you over. Tell me, what are your thoughts as the month of October draws close? How are you looking forward to coming back to the UK?
Oh, very much so. Jan and I are real Anglophiles, and as I said to Peter and Heather May when we were there last time, I could very happily be British. We did my doctoral work in philosophy at the University of Birmingham, and we always enjoy being back in the UK and love the various cities that we'll be speaking in. Are very much looking forward to meeting folks there that we've been corresponding with, as well as having the public dialogue with the audiences. So, yes, we are very much anticipating the trip.
Well, you were last over, as you mentioned, in 2007 and a very successful tour then. But I think, Bill, in all honesty, in 4 years, your recognition has gone up significantly here in the UK. Many more people seem to know about you, probably the internet. And the way it's come on, even in the last 4 years, as a social tool, the advent of YouTube and those sorts of things has played a part in that, would you say?
Yes. 4 years ago, we founded our website called Reasonable Faith. And the UK is one of those countries of the world, I think right after Canada, that is one of our top visitors to our Reasonable Faith website. And then there's this fellow that's established this YouTube channel called Dr. Craig Videos. I have nothing to do with it, but this fellow's gotten literally millions of views from various debates and lectures, some of which were those that were in Britain last time. So I do think that this has really helped to raise the profile of the ministry that we're trying to have. And we're grateful to God for that.
Well, we're really looking forward to welcoming you back. And there's just a good buzz about the tour, lots of excitement. And in fact, press coverage well in advance, back in May, the Telegraph website had an article. And this got to the heart of one of the issues that Peter and I have been grappling with over the last few months of whether Richard Dawkins will debate you on the forthcoming tour. He has resolutely refused to do so. And he's given reasons, various reasons in the past. Tell me, what do you think ultimately is stopping Dawkins from coming forward? The premier atheist in the world, here you are, coming to his hometown. Why won't he step up and debate you, Bill?
I have been told by a person who is in a position to know that the reason Dawkins won't debate me really has nothing to do with me. It has to do with the fact that he was really smarting after John Lennox took him to the woodshed in their debates. And he was frankly embarrassed by his performance. He didn't like the way it went with Lennox and basically determined at that time he's not going to do these sorts of debates anymore because it's simply too humiliating.
Well, that may be so. We're still holding out a vague hope, a possibility that he might turn up at the event we've organised in Oxford at the Sheldonian Theatre on the 25th of October. That will, if he doesn't turn up, be a critique of his book, The God Delusion, his best-selling book. But if he does, there will be a chair waiting for him, just in case.
Excellent.
So we'll see about that. But one of the people who's really been driving this forward, as I say, is Peter May. Peter, you were director of the tour last time Bill came over. Do you think, you know, what are your hopes for the tour this time around?
Well, if it's half as good as last time, I'll be thrilled, because we've been living off the benefits of the last tour in an amazing way over the last 4 years. And we just think of the UCCF website Be Thinking. Bill's many contributions on that website, a lot of it came from the last tour, are the most downloaded things on the website, which means that he's having a colossal impact among students right across the country. So, you know, we want to put more fuel onto that fire.
Obviously.
And
just take us back. It was over a year ago now that I phoned you up and said, Peter, what about getting Bill over again? And I seem to remember that there was a sort of a coincidence at that moment.
Well, there was, you see. I mean, I have been thinking for some long while that, it's now over 4 years, and, you know, Bill's absolutely at the top of his game. It'd be wonderful to have him back here, stirring the pot again. But these tours do take a lot of organising, and I hadn't actually been very well, and one thing and another, it just nagged away my conscience, but I did nothing about it. I deep down, I'm quite lazy, actually. Anyway.
There's no evidence that I can see for that, Peter.
No, there is. My wife will give you ample evidence of that. But anyway, I got this phone call out of the blue from a fellow in Manchester, and he said his name was Andy Kind. Now, I didn't know this fellow at all, and he said his opening shot was... don't you think it's time that Bill Craig came back to Britain? And I said, yes, almost, yes, so what? Yes. and so he then went on and on about. And so I said, well, did you hear Bill last time when he was over in 2000? He said, no, he knew nothing about you then. He's only picked it up from stuff that he's read and from the websites subsequently. And he's just terribly enthusiastic to get you back over here. So we talked for 45 minutes, and I conceded that I agreed with him that this was the time to bring you back. And if he'd just leave me in peace for a bit, I'd mull it all over and just see where it goes and just hope I forget about it again. So we chuckled and we put the phone down. And I just took a deep breath and said, well, you know, it really is time I face this one. And immediately the phone rang again, within a minute probably. It really was just a deep breath away. And there's this fellow Justin on the phone saying, don't you think it's time we got Bill Craig back? I said, you've been talking. And that's what, the fellow who phoned me, this fellow Andy Kind, I said, well, what do you do? Thinking he was a philosopher or something, or a leading Christian. He said, I'm a stand-up comedian. So I thought, brilliant, you know, God's word to me through a stand-up comedian. So then Justin phones up immediately after, and I hadn't spoken to Justin for 18 months, 2 years, something like that. A long period of time. He said, don't you think it's time that Craig came back? I said, you've been talking to a comedian in Manchester, haven't you? And he said, not at all. He didn't know anything about the comedian in Manchester. So I said, well, this is a lot of pressure coming through all of a sudden. It's completely wrecking my day. And within 36 hours, I got a phone call from another friend, Peter Luce, who phoned up and said, Peter, you know, it really is time we got Craig back. So I immediately had three volunteers for the committee.
There you go.
And that was the nudge I needed.
And here we are.
And here we are.
At the verge of the tour. Goodness
yes,
me.
And it's just terribly exciting the way, I mean, that sort of initial nudge has just been followed by other remarkable coincidences and events as the thing has unfolded. So we've got a great sense of expectation for the tour. The time is right. Yeah. There's a lot of interest in Bill's work. And I know many people will want him to do debates all over the country. But, of course, Bill...
Yes, there's been...
the way of madness.
An awful lot of invitations we've had to turn down, of course, in the process of planning this. But, Bill, we must get to some of these questions soon. But one thing I just thought we would just make time for quickly is the news that came out recently that, sadly, after she had agreed to debate you on this opening leg of the tour on Monday the 17th of October, Polly Toynbee, who is the president of the British Humanist Association here in the UK and indeed a noted journalist, then suddenly withdrew her acceptance. She said that she didn't actually, having looked at some of your debates, like the style of the debate, exactly what she didn't like about it. She didn't say. But this was obviously a bit of a shock to me. I thought that was all signed and sealed and delivered, as it were, as a debate that was going to take place. At the time of recording this programme, we are just about at the point of having a replacement in place for you. But what's your response to that rather sudden withdrawal on the part of what is probably, apart from Dawkins and possibly Grayling, the leading atheist in this country?
It really is remarkable, because these folks say in their published statements that they support rational debate and discussion of these issues, and they posture themselves as those who are aggressively pursuing the course of debate. So it really is quite odd. And I can't help but think, given the number of refusals and now this withdrawal, that these folks are talking amongst themselves about this, and that there seems to be a sort of concerted effort to try to boycott participation in this sort of event.
Well, we are looking forward at least to those who have agreed to debate you, Bill. And anyone listening, if you'd like to see the full resume, the full agenda of where Bill will be speaking, the debates that will be taking place, then do I encourage you to check out the Be Thinking website, where it's at the top of their list of things to look at. Bethinking.org is the place to go, bethinking.org, and you can add /Craig if you want to go straight to the relevant webpage. Don't forget, the tickets are available online from Premier, and you can find them at premier.org.uk/Craig. And there's also a web page on the Facebook internet site as well, Facebook page for the Craig tour as well. So don't forget, you can find all of those, of course, from the main portal of all, Unbelievable. premier.org.uk/unbelievable is a good place to go for getting hold of information on the tour, links to the various websites that I've just mentioned.
Perhaps I could just add that there are details yet to be confirmed that we're still talking about, which will go onto the website.
Absolutely.
As they're being fixed up. So
Absolutely.
It is an evolving programme that you
Indeed.
Can see there.
Indeed. So so do check that out. premier.org.uk/Craig for tickets. bethinking.org/Craig for the full programme tour as it currently stands. Well, we're looking forward to all that, Bill. But now it's time to move into looking at some of the questions that listeners to this programme have sent in. And we've had an absolutely full mailbag of questions. And don't forget, if you're listening and you'd like to respond to anything you hear in the course of today's programme, you can also email in and I'll happily read that out on a future edition of the show. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Also available online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Our Twitter account is @unbelievablejb. We're on Facebook too. Bill, I don't know if someone else does all the internet stuff for you, do they? Is that the case? Do you get involved on actually typing stuff into the internet, or do you sort of hand it over to someone?
Well, I write it. For example, I write a question of the week every week and send it into our webmaster, and then he posts it. And I also have a Facebook page where I will give brief comments to various posts that people might put there. But we do have a webmaster who runs the website and handles everything at reasonablefaith.org.
Absolutely. Well, look, let's get to some of these questions that have come in via the various means. People have been sending these in via Facebook, via the Twitter account, via our Unbelievable page on the Premier community. And probably the area that got the most attention was the Kalam cosmological argument. This is an argument that you're quite famous for, Bill, as a kind of evidence for God. Just briefly, in a nutshell, would you run us through the bare bones of what this argument says?
Yes, it's very simple. Premise one is that everything that begins to exist has a cause. Premise two is the universe began to exist. And I present two philosophical arguments against the possibility of an infinite past and two scientific confirmations of this premise to show the universe began to exist, from which it follows three, therefore the universe has a cause. And when you analyze the concept of what it is to be a cause of space and time, matter and energy, many of the attributes of God that are quite striking will fall out of such an analysis.
Well, let's go to a couple of the questions that came in, and a number of these were related, so I'll try to sort of fit them together as far as possible. But Lindley in Sheffield and Seth C asked similar sorts of questions, and they outlined, again, the three basic premises. Firstly, everything that begins to exist has a cause. Secondly, the universe began to exist. Thirdly, therefore, the universe has a cause. But here's Seth's question. He says, but then are you not carving reality up into two distinct categories, that which begins to exist and that which doesn't? If so, what doesn't begin to exist aside from God? Nothing? Then how is this not simply a case of special pleading? Would you sort of have a... What do you make of that question, Bill?
I think that Seth's question shows a lack of understanding of first-order logic of quantified statements. Let me explain. The first premise, everything that begins to exist has a cause, is what logicians would call a universally quantified statement. Statements that begin with words like everything, all, anything, are universally quantified statements about every member of a class. Now, as such, logically, that class may be empty. There might not be anything in that class of things. So that logically, these universally quantified statements have the form of if-then conditional statements. For example, every centaur has four hooves would be analyzed as if anything is a centaur, then it has four hooves. As such, it doesn't imply that any centaurs exist. It's a conditional statement. If anything is a centaur, then it has four hooves. So, similarly, the first premise of the Kalam argument says, if anything begins to exist, then it has a cause. So it's not assuming that there is something like that. It's not a matter of special pleading. It could be an empty class, but it is saying that if there are things that begin to exist, then there needs to be a cause, and the reason for that is that things just don't pop into being out of nothing.
Seth does follow this up with this statement. He says, also, it's been argued that the universe isn't a thing, but a set. Mm-hmm. Therefore, it's incoherent to say that the universe began to exist. What we should say is that such and such within the universe mm-hmm. began to mm-hmm. exist.
Right. Now, that's a quite different argument or question. The universe is clearly not a set, because a set is a mathematical abstract object. I think what he wants to say is that the universe is just particles that are arranged universe-wise, so to speak, but that there isn't a thing called the universe. Well, I think I would respond to that on two levels. I would say certainly in the ordinary language sense of the word thing, the universe is a thing. This is especially evident in the early history of the universe, when the universe was so dense and so hot that there weren't distinguishable objects within it. There are many unique properties that the early universe had: a certain pressure, a certain expansion rate, a certain density, a certain temperature, and so forth. And so the universe exists in the same sense that, say, the Eiffel Tower exists. Now, if you want to get really technical and say, well, the Eiffel Tower as such doesn't really exist, it's just a bunch of particles arranged Eiffel Tower-wise, well, then what we can say with respect to the universe is, for premise one, or rather for premise two, that the particles arranged universe-wise began to exist, from which it follows that, therefore, the particles have a cause. And the argument goes through as before.
I think kind of the central question to some of this is that you say everything that begins to exist has a cause, but in fact, they would say nothing has a cause. Everything goes back to that first cause, because everything that is in the universe is simply, as you said, a rearrangement of the molecules of the universe. It wasn't brought into existence. All of the energy that's required for everything we now see that appears to come into existence actually came into existence at that first cause. So is it fair to say that everything that begins to exist has a cause, when all you're really talking about is actually the universe itself?
This is yet a different objection, I think, Justin. What this person seems to be suggesting is that if a thing has material constituents, then that thing doesn't really exist, that all you have is just particles arranged in a certain way. Now, that is a viewpoint that has a technical name. It's called mereological nihilism. And this is a viewpoint defended by a very small minority of philosophers who think that there are no such things as chairs and people and horses and so forth. Now, if you take this objection seriously, what this means is that Seth himself doesn't exist, that there is no such person as Seth. And that makes me wonder why we should bother responding to the objection, since nobody's ever raised it in a literal sense. But again, even if you think that mereological nihilism is true, which I don't, I think that obviously I exist at least, even if you think there are just particles arranged in different ways, the point still remains that those particles came into existence. They have not always existed, so that you've got to deal with the four arguments I give in support of the second premise that the particles arranged universe-wise began to exist. And apart from dealing with those arguments, you've got no grounds for thinking that matter and energy are eternal in the past.
Well, I hope that at least was a fair representation of the question Jeff asked, which was along those lines. And I think that's the kind of view, the mereological view that he was trying to suggest might be an objection to the Kalam cosmological argument. But in another aspect, the other aspect of the argument that people wanted to question was the whole issue of whether causation makes sense when we're talking about a time before time-space began. And so, for instance, Justin Schieber asks, Dr. Craig, it sure seems that intentional actions require a temporal realm. A desire, which is the motivation for a given action, must be prior to and be causally related to that action if it is to be considered an intentional one. This seems like it would be a pretty standard view. But if time itself has not always existed, but is among the things being brought into existence, it seems to run into a difficulty. This suggests that God has a desire prior to time existing that causally leads to an eventual action. Does it make sense to speak of events being before or after each other without time actually existing yet? Does it make any sense to say that God has created space-time intentionally? What do you say to that, Bill?
It does not make sense to speak of events being before and after each other with time out not actually existing. Before and after are temporal relations. So if you say that you have a before and after, you clearly have time. The question then is, does it make sense to say that God has created space-time intentionally, even though he's not chronologically prior to the beginning of the universe? And I think it does. I don't think that intentional actions require a temporal realm, as Justin seems to think. There's no reason that intentions and the actions that are the result of those intentions couldn't be simultaneous. For example, think of someone who is dangling off of a cliff, hanging onto a tree root to avoid falling. He intends to hold on to that root as firmly as he can, and his intentions are not chronologically prior to the action of fastening his hands around the root. They're simultaneous. So there simply isn't any need to have a chronological priority of intention to action. I think what is prior is a kind of explanatory priority. He holds on to the root tightly because he doesn't want to fall. So there is an explanatory priority of intention to action, but it doesn't need to be a chronological priority. So similarly, I think God can have a timeless intention to create a world with a beginning. And when he does create the world, then I think that is the moment simultaneously at which time comes into existence.
Well, I hope this is already testing your brain, if you're listening. It certainly is mine. And we're taking some of the toughest questions.
It's not my fault, Justin.
No,
it's the
questions. No, absolutely. You know? The questions have to be addressed. You know, these
questions, difficult questions absolutely require technical answers.
Exactly, exactly. And we're not good. This is the forum for that, Bill. You know,
okay.
The listeners to this program know that when they tune into Unbelievable, they get some serious philosophy and theological stuff thrown at them, and that's the way they like it. So we're going to carry on in just a moment's time. I'm going to take a quick break here, and we'll get some more questions that have come in from you, our listeners, to Unbelievable. To put to Bill, we're going to be looking at things like the moral argument. We'll see how many we can fit in the course of the rest of the programme today on Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, also joined in the studio by Dr. Peter May and also by Bill Craig, of course, William Lane Craig, who will be visiting the UK this coming October for the Reasonable Faith Tour 2011. More details at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. We'll see you on the other side of a short break.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
It's the programme that aims to get Christians and non-Christians thinking every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio, but listen to around the world at Unbelievable, the website premier.org.uk/unbelievable if you'd like to hear the programme, tell your friends about it. Don't forget we're on iTunes. You can get us as a podcast, an MP3. You can even find various episodes on YouTube, the ubiquitous YouTube. But it's my pleasure to have on the programme today Bill Craig, who, well, to give him his proper title, is Research Professor of Philosophy at Talbot School of Theology in Mirada, California. But he's well known around the world for not only his philosophical works, but his debating. And he's going to be taking part in a number of debates here in the UK this coming October. So if you want to find out more about that, and indeed the lectures he'll be delivering in the course of his stay here, then do check out the website. You can find more details of the itinerary. That's at www.bethinking.org/Craig. Tickets are available from the Unbelievable website from Premier. That's www.premier.org.uk/Craig. And everything available, of course, as links from the webpage of this programme, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. OK, we've been taking your questions during the course of the last couple of weeks, and many, many of you, and I'm sorry I just don't have enough room to read out nearly anything like all the questions that came in, but we're trying to take a good sprinkling of them across the course of the programme. And Peter May, who is part of the, well, the director, let's say, of the tour, is with me here in the studio as well. Good to have Peter with us as we continue to look at some of these questions. So Bill, let's move on to some other areas. We were talking about the Kalam cosmological argument. Related, but a distinct argument that you use in the course of many of your debates is the what you might call teleological argument, or the fine-tuning of the universe. This is the idea that the universe, as we know from modern physics and science, it appears to have incredibly fine-tuned initial constants that allow it to be a life-bearing universe. And you say, well, either this is pure chance or physical necessity or design, and you rule out chance. Simply the odds are far too great for this to be a chance event. Physical necessity, there appears to be no reason why the figures should fall out in the way they do. So you say the best explanation is design, which points to, of course, a designer. Have I adequately represented the argument?
Very clear. That was a wonderful summary.
Well, thank you very much. I've probably listened to it too many times. but we had a number of questions in regard to this. I think one of the most interesting ones was from Daniel Smith, who is himself a Christian, so not on this occasion an atheist with a question, but a Christian apologist himself. He says, Dr. Craig notes that the thing which needs to be explained is the existence of a universe which can support life, not the fact that we observe a universe in which we could exist to observe it. Dr. Craig says that whatever universe with whatever constants and quantities could have occurred, it is vastly more probable that the universe would not support life than it would support life. In a way, that seems to me to smuggle in teleology, though. Consider this. There is some possible world in which the constants and quantities were fine-tuned such that only helium existed, or hydrogen, etc. Now, considering such a possible world, could we erect the following argument? The fine-tuning of the universe for the existence of helium is due to either law, chance or design. Secondly, it's not due to law or chance. Thirdly, therefore, it's due to design. Couldn't such an argument be formulated for almost any universe which exists, showing that the best explanation of the fine-tuning of any universe for the existence of pretty much anything is best explained by design? And if that's true, doesn't that seem to trivialise the significance of the fine-tuning argument in showing that the best explanation of the fine-tuning of this universe for complex life is design? He says, I don't ask this as a sceptic of Christianity, but I'd love to be able to get behind the fine-tuning argument because so many men and women I respect think it is a pretty good argument. But this is one of my reservations about it. So, Bill, I've always been impressed by this argument, but the issue Daniel raised there struck me for the first time as, that's an interesting sort of objection possibly to it. What do you say in response?
What I would say is that Daniel has assumed too quickly that a universe consisting only of helium or hydrogen is finely tuned. That's simply not the case. That's the whole point of this fine-tuning argument. If you were to simply relax the force of gravity a little bit, you could have a universe that would be nothing but helium or nothing but hydrogen. You don't need to have fine-tuning. The constants don't have to fall within a very narrow range of values for that to happen. So that would be easily explained by simply saying that it's a matter of chance. So life, intelligent life, organisms like ourselves really do stand apart as requiring that these constants and quantities fall within an extraordinarily narrow range of life-permitting values. And it's just not true for something like helium, for example, that that's the case.
So for you, it simply isn't an analogous thing to suggest that a universe of helium would be finely tuned.
Right.
For you, there's actually
right.
quite a it's wide range of values. Mm. Okay, well, fair enough. I think that is a fairly neat packaged answer, actually, to that. One thing that other people raised was that, obviously, the science moves on all the time in this area. Mm. And one of the main things that people have suggested as a way of getting away from design is, well, we could be part of a multiplicity of universes, and we happen to be in the one that had the right constants for intelligent life to emerge. Now, I've always taken that to be just metaphysical speculation, and you might as well go for design as a better explanation that requires less things to it. But recently, I don't know if you've come across this, Bill, there's been some scientists claiming that there is emerging some actual empirical evidence for the suggestion that there may be other bubble universes that we will never meet with, but that there's something in the background radiation, and I'm no expert on this, that suggests that there may be an indication of actually that there is a multiverse which we are part of. What's your view on that?
The multiverse hypothesis is the main competitor to theism today as an explanation of the fine-tuning. This is tremendously significant. It is a tacit admission that you cannot explain away the fine-tuning of these constants and quantities simply by chance without appealing to this extravagant metaphysical hypothesis of this multiplicity of randomly ordered parallel universes. So that in order to avoid theism, the detractors of design are having to recur to, as you say, in a striking metaphysical hypothesis. There was a very good article in the August issue, the cover story, in fact, of Scientific American on the multiverse by George Ellis, who is probably the world's most knowledgeable cosmologist today. And he points out in this article that there is simply no evidence at all for a multiverse, that there isn't any empirical reason to think that such a thing actually exists. And Roger Penrose has very powerfully criticized the multiverse hypothesis as an explanation for the fine-tuning. What Penrose points out in his book, The Road to Reality, is that if the universe were just a tiny part of a randomly ordered multiverse of worlds, that we ought to be observing a much different universe than that which we in fact observe, that our observations would be infinitesimally improbable on the multiverse hypothesis, and that therefore he says this sort of explanation is really quite worthless as an explanation of the fine-tuning. So I think that theism is a better explanation of the fine-tuning of the universe than the multiverse hypothesis.
Well, thank you, Bill. When it comes to this kind of argument, I guess you do have to keep up with the latest in the scientific developments. I mean, Dan, one of the other people who wrote in, said Dr. Craig is often accused of quoting material that's out of date and quoting scientists who have changed their minds. For example, Stephen Hawking allegedly changed his mind about singularities, and many atheists make a good deal about a good number of Dr. Craig's sources being from the 70s and 80s. How would you respond to such an accusation, asked Dan?
Well, I think it's very odd that Dan would say that I appealed to Hawking about singularities. On the contrary, if you look at my published work, I've been interacting with the Hartle-Hawking model for years. That was first broached in 1983. I've sat down personally with Hartle, James Hartle at UCSB in California. He's the co-author of the model with Hawking. And Quentin Smith and I debated this in our book, Theism, Atheism, and Big Bang Cosmology, published by Oxford University Press. So it's not at all the case that I have somehow ignored or overlooked Hawking's model, quantum gravitational model of the origin of the universe, quite the contrary. And in my most recent work with physicist James Sinclair, we interact with quite a range of contemporary cosmological models, many of which are very speculative. In our book, The Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology, published by Blackwell in Oxford. And James and I have an article coming out in a volume to be published by Palgrave Macmillan that's edited by Professor Nagasawa at the University of Birmingham on religion and science, in which we interact with a number of these models as well. So I think that this allegation is simply incorrect and probably reflects an unfamiliarity with my published work. What I would say is this, that when an author makes a sound philosophical point, then it doesn't matter whether that quotation comes from the 1970s or the 1980s. When Anthony Kenney, for example, says that a proponent of the Big Bang Theory, at least if he is an atheist, must believe that the universe came from nothing and by nothing, he's making a philosophical point about the origin of the universe on the standard Big Bang model, and that this can't be explained by something naturalistic. It has to recur to either a supernatural cause or the universe just came into being out of nothing. And that philosophical point is timelessly valid and doesn't go out of date.
Bill, let's move on to another area that you often use in your debates, the moral argument. Now, the moral argument is something that's a bit of a pet favourite of mine as well. It often comes up in one form or another here on the show when we're talking with atheists. It's something that, and I'll bring Peter May in at this point, is something we invited A.C. Grayling to debate you on, because he has recently written a book here in the UK, you may be getting it out there in the States as well, called The Good Book. Peter, you've read it. Describe to us what this good book is. And
I haven't read it.
Oh, you haven't. I apologize.
I've browsed through it and seen the structure of it. I mean, it is set up as a mock Bible. Its opening section is called Genesis, and it then moves on to histories and other sort of sections which are directly imitating the Bible. And to call it the good book isn't exactly subtle, is it? So it seemed to me when I was quite interested to hear that he was publishing it this year, because I thought, well, that would be great, because he will certainly be keen to promote the book, and he must surely be under some moral obligation, if that's the right phrase to use, to debate the foundations of morality. And so I was very interested in the possibility.
Well, what's interesting about this book is he's deliberately set out not to use any religious source whatsoever. It's all from non-religious, atheist, humanist sources.
Humanist writings down the centuries.
Down the centuries. Yeah. What some critics have pointed out is that actually many of the quotations he's lifted from people are from people who were religious sometimes. Also, that some of these were inextricably linked to religious thought in some way or another. But it's a curious book. It's not in any way a rigorous philosophical sort of thing. It's much more a sort of rhetorical exercise in attempting to suggest that, well, we can all get our moral foundations. We don't have to have religion to do that.
Yes, absolutely.
And so he does seem to be laying something out.
And it's not as though the moral question is irrelevant in our society. I mean, we're facing in Britain enormous moral problems. We've not only had appalling riots and looting and widespread theft and destruction going on in our society, but we've had this dreadful scandal over politicians claiming monies which out of the public purse, which they had no right to claim at all. And then we've had this dreadful phone hacking saga with the press. And even the police have been incriminated in corruption at this level. So in a country that's reeling with moral problems in the face of the dominant secularism, it did seem to me that there was a very sound reason why somebody like A.C. Grayling should front up and debate the basis of morality. So I was just quite shocked, really, at his trivial answer to that thing, that he was in a debate fairies and water nymphs.
Yes,
I just thought that was pathetic.
He responded to me saying that he'd rather debate the existence of water fairies and nymphs. I don't know. What do you make of that, Bill? I mean,
I think it's a tremendously condescending statement. It's an arrogant statement to say the level of question that you're interested in is on the same level as debating an absurd question like fairies, nymphs, or leprechauns. It's a very condescending.
It occurs to me that it's almost begs the question, though, because he says it's equivalent, you know, your God has as much proof for him as a fairy or a water nymph. But that's the whole thing we're trying to get to the bottom of, isn't it?
That whether exactly, there is that's there the is issue proof. For
debate. So it's sort of, you know, he's obviously decided his thoughts on it and isn't prepared to debate it. But never mind. As I say, I'm sure we'll expect that to be part of what you speak about in the course of the tour when it comes along in a few weeks' time, Bill. But let's turn to the moral argument itself. And again, if you'll allow me to attempt, and you can correct me, Bill, to sort of give at least a précis of what the moral argument is about. It's the idea that most people recognise that there are objective moral values in the world, that certain acts are wrong at any time, in any place, and therefore we must ask ourselves, upon what basis do we see that these objective moral values exist? If we do live in an atheistic universe where there is no transcendent reality, we are simply a byproduct, really, of evolution, the purposeless forces. We are, at an ultimate level, simply molecules and electrons interacting in complex ways. Upon what basis can we say that anything is right or wrong? Are we not simply expressing individual preferences, if anything at all, when we say that? And that sort of many atheists don't like that conclusion because it means that we aren't in a position to say, no, you're wrong as a society for, you know, getting rid of your female babies because you'd rather have male ones. Mm. You know, we like to take the moral high ground on things. And yet, upon what basis can we do it if there is no moral, ultimate moral lawgiver? OK, that's my slightly wordy way of putting the moral argument. As ever, a number of people have questions regarding this.
If I might just issue a small
please
caveat.
Do. I'm sure I've left out something fairly major.
I think that what many atheists would say is that moral values are not simply a matter of personal preference. That would be a sort of arbitrary subjectivism. But they would say that moral values are the byproducts of biological and social evolution that have been ingrained into us by their survival value and social utility. So it's not as though we just make them up. They're the products of biological evolution. Now, that doesn't make them any more objective and binding, but it would just provide a sort of different explanation of where they come from.
Absolutely. But let's go to a question. Here's one from Javak, who says, I have a cat, Molly, who likes to go out at night. Sometimes I hear noises from beyond the garden fence, which I know are telltale signs of the local tomcats, in inverted commas, enjoying her company. Now, if morality is an evolved trait, it's entirely understandable why it would only apply to select species. But if morality is objective, in the way you mean it, unless constrained by some other factor, it should apply universally. So my question is this. As rape is a truly horrible crime, and Molly the cat clearly cannot give her consent, should I report these nocturnal encounters to the police as rape? And if not, why not? Okay, is this a substantive objection to the moral argument?
No, it's not. He shouldn't report these to the police as rape. And the reason is because a cat isn't a moral agent. So when one tomcat has sexual intercourse with another cat, it's not doing anything morally wrong because cats aren't moral agents. They're not persons. And so when he says if something is objective, it should be universal, we mean universal among moral agents. But obviously, insects aren't moral agents. Clams aren't moral agents. And I would say cats and dogs and so forth are not moral agents, and therefore they cannot be blamed or held guilty or responsible for what they do. They act on the basis of instinct and genetic input and stimulus. And the point is, I think, from the moral argument, is that if we are just animals, if there is no God, then it's difficult to see why the behavior that we call morality is any more objective than what goes on in the animal kingdom. It seems to me that we would be in the same position as Molly if God doesn't exist.
Dr. Craig, I wonder if you could explain to me, again, as little time as possible in a way, but is the moral argument equivalent to divine command theory, which is where the next question comes from that I'm going to ask?
You know, it's not, actually. That's a very interesting question, Justin. The moral argument, as I frame it, goes like this. If God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. And by objective, I mean mind independent. Two, objective moral values and duties exist. Three, therefore God exists. Now that argument, I think, is a sound argument. The conclusion follows logically from the two premises, and I think each of the premises is true. But that argument itself doesn't tell you how it is that God grounds morality. It doesn't give you a moral theory. That is a quite independent project. Now, I do think that the best way of understanding how morality is grounded is a form of divine command theory, which says that the moral good is grounded in God himself. God, by his very nature, determines the good, and that moral duties then are the result of God's commandments to us, you shall do this, you shall not do that, so that our moral duties or right and wrong arise as a result of divine commands, but those commands are reflections of God's own nature, which determines the good.
Well, let me go to the question then that Michael Keenan Baldwin in this case asks, and he says, some skeptical of Christianity argue that divine command theory renders morality subjective. This is because it would make morality dependent on the opinions and nature of a person. How can we respond to this objection without begging the question by changing our definition of subjectivity to include only humans?
What you should do is to say that God's commandments to us are not arbitrary, but are necessary reflections of his essence, of his nature. It is as impossible for God to be non-loving, non-just, unfair, discriminatory, and so forth, as it is for a square to have no angles. It is logically impossible for God to be other than as he is with respect to his compassion, fairness, and other virtues. So one is not grounding morality simply in the commands of some person, even God. Rather, these commands are reflections of who God is essentially, and that means could not be otherwise.
We're going to take a quick break in order to give ourselves a little bit of extra time to fit in maybe one or two more questions on the other side of a quick break. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. My special guest on the programme today, William Lane Craig, who has been answering some of the questions you've sent in via Facebook, via the Unbelievable Twitter account, via the Premier community. So if you want to find out more about how you can get in touch with the show and indeed find out more about the forthcoming Reasonable Faith Tour with William Lane Craig, then do check out premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can hear this programme there, you can send it on to a friend, you can listen to past programmes, and indeed, of course, you can find the links to the various websites where we are telling you about the tour and where you can find tickets. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Okay, Bill, hold on, and we'll be back with you in a short moment's time. And Peter May also joining me here in the studio for this edition of Unbelievable as we look at some of the questions you've been putting to Bill across the course of the last couple of weeks. Welcome back to Unbelievable, the programme that aims to get you thinking. Well, just before we go into the final part of our Q&A with Bill Craig, the questions you've been sending in over the last few weeks for him, let me remind you that the Reasonable Faith Tour kicks off on Monday the 17th of October when Stephen Law will be facing Bill at Westminster Central Hall on the subject, Does God Exist? I hope you can join me for that opening event of the tour. Do tell your friends about it. It's going to be a great time had, I'm sure, as we hear a really substantive debate between Bill and Stephen Law, who's an atheist philosopher. Also, exciting news of another debate alongside the three public debates that are going on. Just this last week, it was confirmed that Bill will be taking part in a debate at the Cambridge Union, which is, of course, a historic debating society. And that's going to be an English style of debate. Bill will be opposite two people, and I believe that's been confirmed as being Arif Ahmed, who has been on this programme before. He's an atheist philosopher from Cambridge. And also Andrew Copson, the chief executive of the British Humanist Association, who, again, no stranger to this programme. And interesting that the British Humanist Association have, it appears, decided to come forward. Andrew Copson will be representing humanism here in this country. It's a shame that we couldn't get their top bod as was originally planned, but Andrew, I'm sure, will be a very substantive opponent for Bill. And as I said, the English style that they're going to be employing at the Cambridge Union involves two speakers on each side, and so Bill is going to be joined for the theistic position, the Christian position, by Peter S. Williams, who is a philosopher. He works alongside the Damaris Trust and writes books. And funnily enough, he's going to be joining me next week. So that's good, isn't it? Peter S. Williams, my guest on the show next week. I'm sure we'll talk about the tour, but we'll also talk about his new book, Understanding Jesus. And that's just been published this month. And we're going to be taking a variety of questions, again, in a similar style to those Grilla Christian programs that we sometimes do here on the show. We'll be taking a few people by phone with their questions for Peter on the person of Jesus, historically, philosophically, theologically, some of the hard questions to put to him that he's addressed in his book. So looking forward to that. Peter S. Williams on the show at the same time next week. Let's get into the final part of today's program.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to spend an hour or so in the company of William Lane Craig. Sorry that we couldn't get to all the questions that were sent in for this programme. Many of you had questions for Bill, who is the research professor of philosophy at Talbot Theological College in Mirada, California, but travels the world speaking, teaching, debating, and indeed publishes many books and more things besides in the area of Christian philosophy and apologetics. So it's been great to put some of your questions to Bill across the course of the programme today. Peter May also still with us. Peter is part of the organisation bringing Bill over for the tour that he's doing here in the UK in October. Do get your tickets, tell your friends. If you have sceptical friends who like to really think through these kinds of issues, this will be perfect for them. Bring them along to a lecture happening. There's lectures happening all over the place, Cambridge, Oxford, Southampton. There's probably one happening near you. And if they like a bit of the, fisticuffs, well, not fisticuffs, gentlemanly debate. There'll be some of those as well happening in London, in Manchester, in Birmingham. And there is, of course, the Big Day conference happening in London halfway through the tour, Saturday the 22nd of October. There's a National Apologetics Training Day, courtesy of Be Thinking, at Westminster Chapel. All tickets available for that. Bill will be joined by the likes of Gary Habermas, John Lennox and Peter J. Williams, a fantastic lineup of speakers that you'll want to go and see on that Saturday. All available, as I've said before, premier.org.uk/Craig for your tickets. Find out more about the details at bethinking.org. OK, Bill, thank you for joining us today. As we wrap up today's programme, just sneak in one more question, a bit more of a general one on this occasion. Stephen Bean got in touch and said, Bill, do you believe there's any difference between your methods and the Apostle Paul's methods of evangelism?
Well, I think there is a difference. I think the Apostle Paul had the advantage of signs and wonders, which I unfortunately don't have. And I mean that seriously. Paul would write to his churches and say, weren't the signs of a true apostle performed among you? And some, like the late John Wimber, have called us to perform power evangelism, as he called it, that we ought to be doing signs and wonders as we evangelize or share the gospel. And for better or worse, God just hasn't gifted me in that way. So that difference certainly exists. But having said that, there's a great deal of commonality between the way I do evangelism and what the Apostle Paul did. Paul wrote in his second letter to the church in Corinth, Greece, the following words. He said, "We destroy arguments and every proud obstacle to the knowledge of God, taking every thought captive to obey Christ." And when I read those words, I thought, what a striking description of what I'm about as well, trying to interact with the arguments that are offered by secularism against the truth of Christian theism and taking every thought captive to obedience to Christ. And so when the Apostle Paul would go into a city, he would enter a Jewish synagogue, and he would argue with the people there from the scriptures that Jesus of Nazareth was the promised Messiah. And when dealing with Gentile audiences, Paul would appeal to the evidence of nature, to cosmology, in effect, the witness of nature to an eternal and powerful creator of the world. And he would appeal to the conscience of God's moral law written on the hearts of all people, a sort of moral argument, if you will. So I find in Paul also this great appeal to the intellect and to evidence in support of Christian theism. And to move beyond mere theism, Paul would cite the witnesses to the resurrection of Jesus as testimony that it is through Jesus of Nazareth that God has especially revealed himself. And he said it is by raising him from the dead that God has shown he has appointed this man as the one by whom he will judge the world. And Paul would rent the Hall of Tyrannus, for example, and hold daily lectures there and invite anyone to come and interact with him on these issues. And so I resonate very much with the methods of Paul insofar as he appealed to the power of argument and evidence in support of the truth of the Christian gospel that he proclaimed.
It's been great having you on with us, Bill. You speak of renting halls, that Paul did that back in his day. Well, it still goes on today. We're renting some halls this coming October, at some of them at a pretty pricey rate, it has to be said, but we're trying to make this as cheap and affordable as possible for people to come to. Tell us a bit more, Peter May, about what we're trying to do in terms of this tour and getting people along.
Well, I'm glad you raised this issue of the costs, because a tour like this does actually cost quite a lot to put on, and the only way we can really share that cost with a lot of people is by charging tickets. So most of the events will require tickets. We've tried to keep them as low as possible. We're not out to make money from this tour, but we are keen to pay the bills at the end of it. And one of the things that we're keen to do, and because of the success last time of filming the events, we want to film as much as we can. And that's an expensive operation. So there are big bills to pay at the end of it all. And if anyone would like to offer us a large sum of money, I wouldn't mind accepting it, because I'm sure we will spend the money that we will bring in. But that's why there are tickets and why we're making special concessions in many places for students, so they won't have to pay more than £5. So that for £10, they can bring a friend to one of the lectures or debates or whatever.
Absolutely. And very much we're hoping that this isn't just going to be a whole horde of Christians turn out to these events, that Christians will
quite
be emboldened
so.
to suggest it to their friends, to perhaps, you know, and they won't be bombarded with worship music or anything like that. This will be very much an event which they'll be comfortable in bringing
yes,
people
absolutely.
To.
Absolutely.
Great. Well, that said, do get along yourself. Let your church know about this. If you're someone who's passionate about the intellectual defence of the gospel and these sorts of ideas and the kinds of lectures and debates that Bill takes part in, do tell people in your church about it, and do tell them to invite their friends who might be interested in this kind of a tour along. We'd love to see you there. I am looking forward to greeting many, many people at Westminster Central Hall for the opening night of the tour on Monday, the 17th of October, when Bill will be in debate with a notable atheist. And we are looking forward to the rest of the tour as well, that I've mentioned some of the details of in today's programme. Bill, thank you for joining me on the programme, as I said, and we look forward to meeting you again in October.
My pleasure, Justin. It's been a real fun to talk with you and Peter, and I'm so grateful to Peter May for all of the tremendous work and effort that he's put into this tour.
Well, not at all. We're just thrilled that you're prepared to give us 10 days of your life to come and work with us over here. We're very excited about it, Bill.
Well, thank you again, Bill. Thank you for listening. And if you'd like to get hold of this programme, as I say, more details and of the tour, indeed past programmes that Bill's contributed to here on Unbelievable, do check out the webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. If you've got questions, I'm more than happy to answer them if you send me an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and that's also the email address for your comments on today's programme. We'll be hearing some of your feedback to previous programmes in a short moment's time. In the meantime, my thanks again to Peter and to Bill and to you for listening, and we look forward to welcoming many, many people along to the Reasonable Faith Tour this coming October in 2011. Right now, we're going to move on to looking at some of your feedback in the last few weeks.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, it's been a great time today. Thank you for listening. And now, if you want to book in for the tour, just one final time, I'll mention that you can do that by visiting premier.org.uk/Craig. Please pass that on to your friends, your family, to your church, to your fellow sceptics, if you're an atheist or an agnostic. It's a great way to spend an evening hearing to really top brains discussing and debating these ideas. But there's also some great lectures going on where there'll of course be Q&A to follow and that sort of thing. So premier.org.uk/Craig to book yourself in. Don't forget, you can find full tour details, press updates, things like that going on at the BeThinking website as well, bethinking.org, if you want a little bit more sort of general news and information on the tour. As I said earlier, you can find a Facebook page as well. We've created that recently, and you're welcome to like it, and we'll be updating that with tour news and various interesting bits and pieces as the weeks progress. So if you want to find that, again, a link from the Unbelievable page, but if you're on Facebook right now, facebook.com/reasonablefaithtour. Do like the page and check out the events that are associated with that, and pass it on to others. That's a good way as well of raising people's awareness of the various events that are going on. You can share that event with your Facebook friends, invite them along as well. So do that if you can. If you would like to advertise these events in your church or to people around you, we've got some flyers available. You can actually email me if you want to pick up some flyers, if you want them sent to you for events that are going on near you. Unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And so tell your friends, why not bring a group from your church if you're a Christian and you attend a church near you? If you're listening and you're a skeptic, you're an atheist in a local sort of skeptical organisation, why not bring a delegation from your end as well? And there'll be time at the debates for Q&A, at all the lectures as well for Q&A. So I look forward to seeing many of you there. Premier.org.uk/Craig if you want to book in. Just 5 weeks to go till that kicks off. So we're looking forward to seeing many people there as word spreads further afield of the tour. Well, I've left myself a reasonable chunk of time now to be able to tell you all about some of the feedback we've been having in the past few weeks to this programme. And a lot of interest in the programme of a few weeks ago now, with Rebecca Benich telling her story as a former Christian, now an atheist. She was in conversation with Sheridan Voysey on that occasion. Before we get to her and some others' responses, let me say, last week we had that discussion between Patrick Sukdeo and Mohammed Al-Husseini on Islam, apostasy and conversion. Here's what Bruce Medeiros wanted to say. I thought the recent discussion was brilliant. Can I suggest you get them both on together for another topic relating to Islam and Christianity? What I found refreshing about the programme was that even though both individuals were in different camps, because of their relationship, they clearly showed respect to each other, which you don't often get on your programme. I was intrigued when you apologised at the beginning of the programme that the two speakers were likely to be agreeing. It would appear that you would prefer to have two arguing. Is that because you want to increase ratings for the programme? The more arguments, the more listeners? Sounds a bit like the world's mindset. I've got no problem with polemics. The only problem is it often degenerates into an unfriendly experience for them and for the listeners. Well, yes, perhaps I should have had a slap on the wrist for sort of perhaps insinuating that it was a bad thing that wasn't going to be argy-bargy. It was a very interesting show without that. But obviously, generally, the way this show works, obviously not in today's context, but with two opposing views, it is adversarial, let's say. And so that is kind of, I suppose, what most people expect when they tune into Unbelievable. Let's go to a week or two back now. That was Bart Ehrman and Mike Licona discussing their respective faith journeys, Bart's loss of faith, Mike going through a crisis of faith but holding on to his faith, both stemming from their view, their kind of changing view of Scripture. Thanks to all those who got in touch. Again, Ken wanted to comment on this one to say that it's always sad to hear of someone losing their faith as Bart did, particularly over matters that really don't worry other Christians. Bart mentioned his belief in the inerrancy of Bible was attacked when he realised that in Mark 2:26, Abiathar is referred to instead of Ahimelech. Well, here's John MacArthur's take on that. The phrase "in the days of" can mean during the lifetime of. According to 1 Samuel 21, Ahimelech was the priest who gave the bread to David. Abiathar was Ahimelech's son, who later was the high priest during David's reign. Since Ahimelech died shortly after this incident, it's likely that Mark simply added this designation to identify the well-known companion of David, who later became the high priest along with Zadok. So you just wanted to clear up what you think is not a very difficult sort of apparent Bible contradiction that was the kind of the first staging post, apparently, in Bart's story. Though, of course, there's a lot more to it than that. Gav in Australia says, love the programme, love the content and how varied it is. On the conversation between Bart and Mike, as much as I sympathise with Bart, for me, there are things in this world that just cannot be reconciled without the supernatural. I think if we're honest with ourselves, we know deep down that love and kindness is more than just chemicals. We know that anger and anguish is more than just the reactions of material things in our brain. We cannot deny how real consciousness is, how our morals are so real. The question I hope Bart comes to is not God can't exist because of the problem of suffering, but how can we account for consciousness, let alone love and these feelings we have without a God? Of course, Bart hasn't labelled himself an atheist per se. He does stick to the title agnostic, though, of course, different people have different definitions of where that would put them on their sort of view about God. Wes is an avid fan from the States, he says. Interesting show with Bart and Mike.
I loved hearing from Bart over the course of your show, and I think he brings an interesting while unsettling perspective for most Christians. I would have liked to hear Bart talk more about the personal struggle he went through when he lost his faith, and why in particular the problem of suffering was so pivotal for him. Was there some sort of personal crisis or dilemma linked with that problem that seemingly pushed him over the edge? Mike was a great balance to the programme, and I identify very much with his faith journey. Mike was right to include all the evidence when making a personal decision about his faith, where it seemed that Bart has built his ideology on questions versus what we know as fact, and then he still seems to have concluded that he's an agnostic and can't know if there is a God. Well, that seems to be a very shaky foundation indeed. A better way would be building your faith on what we can know for sure. Mark, I think, takes the correct approach in weighing the bulk of the Christian evidence. I think you mean Mike there rather than Mark. But sometimes it seems we can get so confused on debating particular arguments for or against certain aspects of Christianity while ignoring the big picture, and we end up missing the forest for the trees. If all evidence is weighed in philosophy, science and history, I firmly believe that God comes out on top by a clear margin. Thank you, Wes, for getting in touch, and I'll just try and squeeze in one more on Bart and Ehrman. Here, let's do Richard, who says, I listen by podcast, love the show. This is probably late getting into you, not too late for me, actually. When listening to the podcast, Ehrman seems to, again, you repeat the very same phrase here, lose sight of the forest for one or two bad trees. He jumps into the middle of things without looking at either end. What I mean by that is, if you take the arguments used by, for instance, William Lane Craig and build a case, well, I believe Ehrman is agnostic, but the logic still holds. Where did the universe come from? How was our universe fine-tuned for life? Where does objective morality come from? You have to answer those questions first. I add in a few of my own, such as how did inorganic material become organic? So there's all kinds of other issues that you would have to sort of grapple with before taking a sort of firm stance as an agnostic or atheist, as you say. And you go on to say, you also have to further look at the fact that Judaism wasn't just a religion, it was an identity of those people, their nationality, full of history and tradition. And to say that some band of uneducated illiterates caused a mass of Jews to follow them, only to be persecuted and rejected by their own people, just doesn't make any sense. If Jesus was who he claimed to be, it makes a lot more sense. Thank you very much for your comments on those shows. So let's go to the week before that. And this was the show with Rebecca Benich, and in not dissimilar fashion, a former Christian like Bart, obviously a different sort of journey that took her out of faith. But let's see what you've been saying in regard to her. Last week I brought a couple of emails in regard to that, a couple of people suggesting, was she really a Christian? You know, do real Christians lose their faith, and the rest of it. Rebecca's been responding to that on Facebook, on the Unbelievable group, on the Facebook group of Unbelievable. So you might want to check out some of her responses to those suggestions. But here is Mike in Toronto, who says, a great show, Justin. There's so much here to contemplate. Rebecca's comments that atheism isn't a philosophy or a worldview I find quite naive. She says atheism has never claimed to provide ultimate answers to meaning of life questions. Moving from one system that has answers one doesn't like or doesn't fully understand to a system with no answers seems to me to be a backward step. If I didn't believe that the Spirit of God aids Christians who sincerely and humbly pursue God, the simple lack of consistent answers offered by a humanist or atheist view would keep me from straying from the faith. And in fact, that is my story. Like Rebecca, I grew up with a Christian upbringing, and after a series of unanswered questions and bad answers to questions, disappointments with the church and Christians in general, I left the Christian faith. But what secularism offered in return was a morass of inconsistent, pseudo-spiritual, cold scientific Darwinian survival of the fittest hedonism. A great worldview if you're a rich white male living in North America, but really lousy if you're a poor unwed mother living in a third world country. And I guess atheism also works well if you're an educated female feminist humanist living in the Canadian Midwest. As a disillusioned ex-Christian, I could have easily embraced an altruistic cause or championed a political party for social reform, but I realised that I could and should be involved in these causes as a Christian, and that I'd simply be evading the real issue. So after an investigation of world religions, I came back to faith with the knowledge that if there are ultimate answers, I will find them
in Jesus. Bridget says, I listened to the podcast with Rebecca with interest because I have an atheist brother-in-law and sister, and it was with sadness that I learned that committed believers could decide in this way to become apostates. I've taken it as a warning for me. I can sympathise. I've found the Bible difficult at times, and it can breed cynicism or despondency. People keep quiet when you have questions sometimes, and you don't know what the real thoughts are that are going on inside. But usually at such times I needed to rest and then for the Lord's Spirit to persuade me that actually things can make sense. My viewpoints on the program, firstly, we can have natural doubts, and at such times there should be plenty of opportunities, such as Bible weekends, to get them answered. Otherwise, the doubts can come in, tempt us to give up the faith. And believing, thirdly, you say, is a choice. And we choose to believe. Had I chosen to remain in doubt, that would have been a step backwards. We can take steps forwards or backwards, says Bridget. Let's go to this one from Strino in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Says, great podcast. During the debate between Rebecca Benedge and Sheridan Voysey, you spent little time on the question of whether someone can be an ex-Christian. So we're going back to this issue of whether the term is an oxymoronic in the first place, perhaps because they seem to be in agreement. Well, you interjected a quote from 1 John, but I wasn't sure what your view was. Rebecca seemed to define her Christianity by her accomplishments, citing Bible college, teaching the Bible and others' good works as a proof of her faith. Sheridan agreed that her track record showed that she seemed to be a Christian. But true Christianity is a relationship with Jesus and with God through Jesus. All the colleges and seminaries and good works in the world won't make you a Christian. You can prophesy in the name of Jesus and cast out demons, according to Matthew 7, and not be a Christian. I have a relationship with my wife, and if she were to somehow disappear or go away tomorrow, nothing could ever convince me that she never existed. My relationship with God is just as real and has had a great impact on my life. If I woke up tomorrow and didn't feel like a Christian or had some terrible experience, it could never make me think there must not be a God. Anyone who's truly met the living God could never be persuaded that he doesn't exist. There you go. So what do you make of that, Rebecca? Get in touch. Let me know your thoughts on some of those. And I'm sure you'll be posting them up as well at the Unbelievable group on Facebook. Also, of course, you can find an Unbelievable group at the Premier Community. Links to all of those from the webpage. Well, we're out of time. So time to say thank you for listening. And just a final reminder, do book in 5 weeks' time. William Lane Craig starts his tour here in the UK. Debates and events going on in London, Manchester, Birmingham, Cambridge, Oxford and Southampton. Do check out the webpage, premier.org.uk/Craig. Next week on the programme, here's what's coming up.
You're unbelievable.
Peter S. Williams has just written and published a new book called Understanding Jesus. He'll be here to tell us about it. Peter S. Williams is a Christian philosopher and apologist. He'll be taking some questions from listeners to Unbelievable with their concerns, questions, queries about the person of Jesus historically, theologically and philosophically. Hope you can join me for that programme. Same time next week. Until then, have a great week.